Welcome to Vermont Favorites, a production of WBTV LP Burlington, 99.3 FM. I'm Adam Rabin. Each week I talk with musicians, artists, performers, and creators about their unique journeys and what they love about living in Vermont. My guest today is an accomplished musician who has worked in bands as well as in theater, and he wrote the epic number for Stuck in Vermont's 500th episode. And like me, he is a Vermont 251er on the quest to visit all 251 of Vermont's cities and towns. He started his trek after me, which is odd, as he is not only a native Vermonter, but he has lived in Chittenden County, how about that, his whole life. Please welcome Vermont favorite, Nate Vennett. I said that right, huh?
You did, Adam.
Excellent. I always thought it was Vennett, but it's Vennett.
It's Vennett, shortened from Vinetsky. It's Polish originally. So,
okay. Yeah. I knew you were a native Vermonter. I was thinking it was some kind of like a French thing, but it's not at all.
No, of course, growing up in school, I stopped correcting teachers after about fifth grade. So,
yeah, I understand. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's Vinetsky, huh? Mm-hmm. That's what it's from. Okay, because my grandfather was born Rabinowitz. And probably for similar reasons said, let's make it simpler.
A lot of people's families changed to Ellis Island either of their own accord or because the people at Ellis Island decided to change it. But for me, it was like my great-grandparents were all immigrants, mm-hmm. But it was my grandfather who changed it for business reasons, to sound less ethnic for work.
So. Back in the day. Mm-hmm. Right on. That's exactly what happened in my family as well. You said your grandfather changed his name. Was he already in Vermont at that point?
No, he lived in New Jersey and was an ad executive, actually. Eventually was one and had his own agency. And my parents came to Vermont the year before I was born in 1979. My dad came up for a job at IBM. So
gotcha. So your family is recent to Vermont.
Yes.
But that's where you came on the scene.
Exactly.
Nice. And you've stayed here the entire time.
I did. With mostly no regrets.
Mostly no. What do you mean mostly?
I have some people want to get away.
Yeah.
I never really wanted to get away. I love that I'm here, but I also kind of regret not taking the opportunity during college or perhaps right after to just kind of go somewhere else.
Yeah, see what else
before
is out there.
I had more things tying me here.
right. It gets harder as you get older. It's funny. Just about everyone I know, whether they're native. Well, actually, mostly, the natives, they all go away at some point, whether it's college or just to try, another city. And then half the time, or actually probably more than half the time, they come back. And you've just been happy to be in Vermont this whole time.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, you talk to so many people who come here, usually for UVM or Champlain, or come to Burlington for college and never leave. Mm-hmm. and I think if you can understand that, then that was true for me too. In a way, I grew up not only a half an hour from here, but moved to Burlington for UVM, and it's a pretty great place.
Moved to the big city.
The big city. Yeah. Well, it certainly was. Then,
compared to Jericho,
compared to Jericho, exactly, and even even now, there's a lot here. It's no New York, but
no, we like to think it is, though.
It's a small, it's a borough.
Every once in a while, I think about how small Burlington is. I was thinking about about that, and. And then I walk down Church Street, or I'm sitting in a restaurant. I was like, I don't know anyone else in this restaurant. Mm-hmm. So clearly, it's bigger than my own scope of living. If I don't know every single person, I mean, it's kind of a crazy thing to say or think. But there are so many stories, so many people, even just within the one, medium-sized, small city.
Absolutely. But it's also the exact opposite, right? I mean, there are days when I can go down to Church Street, yeah. go downtown, and see thousands of people, none of whom I recognize. And there yeah. are other days when I can walk down Church Street, and it's like every half a block, I'm like, oh, hey, I haven't seen you in a while. Hey, what's going on? How are things? So that's one of the things I really love about Burlington, too, is that if I am feeling like I want to be anonymous, I can get that feeling. and if I want to feel like it's a small town and, you know, I want to go where everybody knows your name, like that exists also, like at the same time.
Yeah, it's kind of a New England thing. I was just talking with someone about this yesterday, is, you know, that New England mentality of knowing to mind your own business, knowing how to mind your own business. You know, so even if it's like someone that you know or that you work with or that you dealt with, like, you know, for a few years ago, and you're right behind them in line at the supermarket, it's totally acceptable to just not acknowledge that they're there.
Yes, though that can feel a little funny, a little awkward, especially if you make eye contact.
Well, once you make eye contact, it's all over. I have to say something.
Absolutely. I used to do a lot of theater at schools for a long time, and you know, I'm sure this is even more true for teachers who see a lot more students in a year than I do. But you know, after 10, 11, 12 years of doing theater at four different schools and summer camps and stuff, there are always people that I see who I know or I think I know.
Oh, that's the
worst.
Or
they think they know me, right? And I'm like, oh, you were at Frederick Tuttle in 2005 and 6.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen you in like 8 years, but you still look familiar enough that I'm like, who are you?
Yeah.
What,
how do I know you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It creeps up on me also. Mm-hmm. And that's the worst feeling, because it's like, do I just recognize you because you're always on Church Street, or you were, you know, you work at a place like you've worked at that coffee shop forever. And I just kind of subliminally remembered your face because I see you all the time.
Yes.
But not actually know you.
I love the people. I mean, being in a place for a long time, there are people who I've never met, but who I, you know, maybe they look unique in some way, or we just happen to cross paths a lot. But there, I'm like, oh, that's that guy, that's that woman, that's that person,
right?
Who I see all the time walking in this neighborhood,
right.
Or whatever. I dig that. There's a guy right now. I live in Winooski now. And there's a guy who I'm pretty sure I recognized him from Burlington, as well. But I see him walking sort of in some of the same times and places as I do. And I have no idea who he is. He's been around for a long time, 'cause I've recognized him for a long time. But, you know, we're just sort of sitting in this community together, I guess.
It's that understood, like, coexistence, but you don't have to put on a happy face.
Right.
it's Vermont. We're as happy as we want to be.
Yes.
Yeah. So you grew up in Jericho. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And so you've done all these musical things. What was it like, say, in your childhood? Because that's when most people get the bug.
Yeah. I didn't start taking piano lessons until middle school. Mm-hmm. I didn't really do theater the way that other people say they do theater in some sort of consistent way. I'm sure I was in some little school, you know, or history classes putting on a skit or whatever, but I didn't really do theater until the end of my sophomore year in high school. I think I listened to it a lot. I was a big, you know, I loved a lot of old movie musicals. So I was just talking to a friend the other day. There's a revival of My Fair Lady about to happen, and like I watched that movie so many times, and I had the soundtrack, and I could sing you all the words to, you know, to everything. Fiddler on the Roof, another one. So, you know, I listened to a lot of musicals and watched them, but I didn't do theater. It was very accidental. Kind of.
How did you fall in? What was the accident?
The accident was really just that I had friends who, you know, I'm a band kid, I guess. So, right. So, and a chorus kid. So I had a lot of friends who were also doing theater, and my high school did a production of Tommy. My junior year, and they need a lot of keyboards for that. Yep. And so the band teacher, you know, sort of asked me, "Hey, you know, would you audition to play in the pit band?" You know, I wouldn't have gone out and done that on my own, but they were like, "Right. Oh, you know, do it." And I, you know, knew Tommy, you know, the Who's album, ish. And so anyway, I did it, and it was, I think, a pretty great success. And kind of gave me the bug for doing musicals and not just listening to them.
It's interesting that your first foray into theater was rock.
Yeah.
Do you think that made it easier? Because that's, you know, it's a very, I mean, it's a rock album that was adapted.
Yeah. Well, it made it more accessible to me, you know, not to diminish the work that goes into rock music, but, you know, a lot of musicals, what do you want to say? The keys were easy. Right. There's not, a lot of shows, you know, there'll be a song and it'll modulate up a half step and it'll bounce all around and it can get really complicated. And, Tommy, was very straightforward.
You got D suspended and then your D.
Right? That's exactly
that's
it.
That's the whole musical
there are
two right
chords
there.
In that show, sus and regular, right?
Right. the musician geeks in the audience know what we're talking about.
Yeah,
and that's about it.
I'm not sure what language to use for the listeners, but so it was really different, and it did let me. I mean, really, when we did the show, the band was on stage, and we had smoke machines. I mean, it felt like a rock concert, which is not always how that production has to happen. I don't think, but so it did. That was like the excitement for me in a lot of ways, you know, because we're like right out there, and you know,
were you like in the pit in front of the stage looking at the, or were you on stage?
We were on stage. So Norm Schultz, who was our drama director at the time, built like a tiered pinball machine-esque sort of set, and the band was in the dead center of the stage, and the cast played down in front of us, and then like up ramps and on a platform behind us as well. So we were really,
that's a hell of a production for a high school play.
It was I mean, we're all biased towards our
right,
you know, if I had a nickel for any time I've heard someone, myself included, saying, "Oh man, that time that my high school did that thing was the best that it's ever been." So I admit that freely, but also I think it was pretty great, and I you know, it was a it was like the right time for the people. So many of the both cast and band members of that show have gone on to be professionals in
what high school
music.
Was this?
Mount Mansfield.
Right. Okay.
You know, not 50% of them, but you know, enough that I can say, "Oh, it kind of makes sense." Like three of the other band members are like, you know, successful musicians,
right?
You know, either here in town or in New York. One of the leads is a great singer and musical writer and composer in New York who's had some degree of success. And so it does, you know, I sort of look at it and I feel a little validated in my opinion by going, because there are like a bunch of us who kind of kept doing it, you know? Mm-hmm.
There's Vermont has definitely churned out more than its fair share
sure.
of talent. And, you know, anyone listening to music in Vermont knows this already. Yes. I'm not. that's the value of community radio, I guess. Yeah. We can just talk about how great we are and don't have to worry about anyone else disagreeing with us.
Exactly.
So after Mount Mansfield High School, you went on to college. You went to UVM.
I did.
Moving. That's when you moved to the big city of Burlington.
I moved to the big city of Burlington. Yeah, I had a really wonderful time at UVM. Yeah. A lot of different majors,
but not music.
Not music. I had a music minor. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a physics teacher when I went to school.
Yeah.
I think like a lot of people, we don't really have a clear concept of our future.
I can't imagine having. I mean, anybody. Yeah, at 17, 18 years old, how can you have any idea? Yeah. Yeah. What was it about physics? I mean, you've had this music arts background. Mm-hmm. What was the other half of your brain thinking that it was so, you know, getting a job, having a practical?
Yeah, I mean, I like teaching. I had always admired, my teachers, and I believe I did win the teacher's pet superlative at one point, which is sort of an awful thing that classmates bestow on other, other classmates. But I was always a very good student, and I felt comfortable in a school environment. So, I kind of wanted to continue in that way. And I sort of did doing a lot of theater with kids. So I sort of maintained that track a little bit. But I was good at a lot of, to whatever degree I was good at them. I was good at a lot of things, and mm-hmm. I love science and I love books, and I think at the time I had just taken physics as a senior high school senior, and was like, oh, this is really cool. And I built a musical instrument with a couple of classmates for a project, and wind instrument where the length of, of the and the diameter of the pipes affected the pitch, and so that was kind of cool. So I was like, physics, and it describes the world in a cool vocabulary. So
that's exactly what it does. So you didn't obviously you didn't pursue physics as a career, but that's fascinating because it probably still does affect your outlook. You see things through that lens of a little bit of science behind everything, even something as esoteric as music.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, science, I feel like, or physics anyway, it's a vocabulary to mm-hmm. describe things. And I think, poetry is a vocabulary to describe things. And so are equations, and they sort of get you at different sides of things. But
it's all a different way of communicating our experience.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Whether it's through music or physics, that's it's very Feynman-esque of you to describe it that way, or to take that approach. Because he said some great things about the beauty of nature.
Right.
Richard Feynman, that is, and how I wish I had the quote handy, but he was, he talked about the beauty of a rose. It's like, just through science, if you don't take the spiritual tack, how do you appreciate the beauty of a rose? And he talks about, well, I know what goes into making it this color and this shape and blooming this time and not that time.
Right.
And the poetry and the ballet therein. So you after college, you did go on as a music director for various companies. So you were studying music in school, and you applied it, even if not in the official capacity of a graduate.
Yes. I've not held the official capacity of a graduate. Again, almost accidentally started building a career music directing at schools. I got one gig and I really loved it, and gig begot gig, right?
You do well.
And I was able to sort of stop. I had a an office job for a little while, and I was able to sort of leave that and just do theater at three different high schools and one middle school and summer camps and all that kind of stuff. And I was very poor, but it was great.
Yeah. You were a full-time musician, you say.
I was a full-time musician, and I was, you know, doing two to three shows at once almost all year round, except, you know, I would usually have between Thanksgiving and New Year's is pretty, you know, most of the schools are done with their shows at that point. So that would be sort of a break. And then May would usually be a break month, sort of after the spring plays were done and before summer camps and stuff.
How was it working with students, you know, middle school and high school? How do I communicate my brain, you know, what's on my mind to a 12-year-old or to a 14-year-old?
The age, it matters for some things, but other things, not as much. The challenges of doing theater with kids sometimes can just be about focus in the rehearsal process, and that sort of thing. But the things that are difficult for kids are also the things that are difficult for adults, right? I think one of the number one things that is makes performing difficult is self-consciousness, right? And being sort of afraid or not quite having the knowing what the path is to get the thing out of your body that you know is in there.
Get out of your way.
Yes, exactly. And so that looks a little different on adults than kids, but really it's kind of the same thing. You know, I can think of a million times when it's sort of giving kids and adults like the permission to be the character that I know they understand it to be, right? So in that way, it can be really very similar. It also is different, and I don't want
to,
you know.
Yeah, but I mean, imagine like the way you talk to them, you know, the level of humility or the quality of the self-consciousness is probably a little different.
Yes. And, you know, talking with adults, obviously, you know, I can jump into subjects that wouldn't be appropriate for younger kids or just for, you know, even high schoolers, because you're a drama coach and
you just have to
navigate that a little bit while still helping people find the thing that's really personal.
What were some experiences, like some of the real standout experiences working with kids in a theater environment?
Oh man. So many. I mean, the thing that I love about working with kids the most is that when they get sincerely excited about things in a little more raw way, right?
They don't censor themselves the way adults would.
Yeah, and they can be more willing to just go on a journey, not like the journey of the whole character and the whole process. That is something I feel like adults actually have a better handle on. But I just mean, even in the, if I want to try an experiment in rehearsal, the high schoolers in general are going to be much like more about doing that. Right.
Yeah. There is that child, the times when I feel most free as a performer or a writer is when I can turn off that overly analytical adult mind and that mindset of, yeah, but what does this mean and why are you doing this? As opposed to a kid who is just like, I'm doing it because I'm doing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Someone told me I have to.
Yes. Or someone told me I had to.
Which, as adults, we don't like that so much, right?
No.
And that's the other. That's the other thing. And I am. I am equally guilty of this in my process too. Where mm-hmm. there's always, as an adult, there's always a little thing in the back of your head that says, "Well, what makes you think you know better than me?" Right? Like,
yeah, kids haven't. The doubt, the self-doubt, I can only speak to my own experience and maybe, you know, just what I think I understand from observing others. But the doubt, the imposter syndrome that creeps in, mm-hmm. I feel that's actually gotten worse or more present, or I've noticed it more as I've grown up, as opposed to when I was a kid, I just didn't know any better. So there's the two sides of freedom,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The trouble you can get into and then the trouble you're allowed to get into.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So yeah. You did, so speaking of, mm-hmm. you have played with, we'll call them peers, in a band before.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Was that Jean-Jacques? Is that what that was?
yeah. So I one of the longest running groups I was ever in was this group called Deja Nu, which Jean-Jacques is the band leader,
gotcha.
and singer, who took out an ad in 7 days, I think maybe back before the classifieds were even online.
way back.
And Jean-Jacques is from France and worked at IBM here and wanted to put together a group doing French songs. And so I answered an ad, and this was like very shortly after college, we gigged a lot with karaoke tracks, which was.
But he had a band.
Fun and a little weird. Well, not until I brought. He had nothing. That sounds dramatic.
Yeah.
So I showed up, and he had. A stack of karaoke CDs.
Oh,
and
I gotcha.
Said, gotcha. "Hey, I want a piano player to do this
do
with,
this.
But
yeah.
then we'll use the karaoke tracks to also provide, you know, as backing tracks for our gig," which was fine, but a little difficult and weird, especially because most of those tracks also already had piano on them.
Yeah.
So after a while, I said, "Hey, what if we got rid of these CDs and I called some friends.
Yeah. Let's do it for real.
And we like do a band because I'm starting to not have fun.
Yeah. So you put together this band of, you know, people your age.
Yeah.
Ish. And what I was going for, the reason I brought this up is I'm looking for that compare and contrast with the theater, the theater directing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and working with kids in a more, teacher student relationship, right. And then now you're in a band with people who are, or you know, you're kind of playing for Jean-Jacques, but then also with a band of like-minded people.
Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, even though I didn't have the job title of music director,
yeah,
I was kind of the music director,
right?
And I think. That I would sort of define that role as having a vision about the group, about the show, about the gig, about the end product or whatever, and then figuring out how to make that happen,
right?
And how to with whatever resources you have, right? And
it's never an ideal situation you're in,
right? And it's, you know, maybe, oh, I've got like these really great players, but like this one doesn't read music, or this guy or this woman is really wonderful but like doesn't play that genre well, but that's who I've got in the group, and so how do I help bring out in them the thing that's gonna get the group to where I want the group to be, it's the same as theater, you know, in that way.
Yeah, you've got a bunch of kids, you know, in theater,
right?
And you're like, well, they're not going to be able to hit such notes, you know, and they're only going to be able to go so low,
yeah.
or you know,
Yeah. That's, you know, a great example. You know, there are a lot of shows. Most shows are generally written for adult voices.
Yeah.
Sometimes, certainly in middle school, you have no bases.
Anyways, one would hope,
right? And even through high school, right? Depending on the show, like the vocal demands can be really hard to achieve with whom you happen to have, right? And it's right. Like, well, we're gonna make the show the best that it can be,
mm-hmm.
and we're gonna make you as an individual be the best that you can be. But it's true with adults too, you know.
Yeah.
I do a show, music direct, adults with real training and resumes, we'll run into the exact same thing.
Yeah, people get hired for musicals. I mean, especially in a place like Vermont, where there is hard to believe, but there is a finite number of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like New York where you could get anything you want,
right?
Any kind of singer. So, you know, you want to get someone that's available and that'll work for free, you know, and has a great voice and can act.
Right.
So how do you deal with that?
So my philosophy about it, right, is I'm just not a perfectionist in life about anything. And I think anyone listening who knows me would agree. I don't think that's a shock for me to say that. But I do strive for excellence.
Mm.
But there are a lot of different ways to achieve it.
Yeah.
And feel like I believe that if the people involved in a project, if I can bring them to a place where they are feeling as invested as they can possibly be and are feeling good about it, then that's like 90% of getting somewhere great, right? Sometimes being a music director is, oh, we're going to go through some vocal warm-ups and I'm going to give you some, you know, some posture tips and some exercises to do, and we're really going to like hone in and do that stuff. But a lot of it is it's just learning who you are and then figuring out how to give you the environment that makes you go, I'm a rock star and I can do this. And if you can do that, then we can tweak and fix the technical things.
Right.
But until you get there, And a lot of times people, I think, worry about the technical pieces first and believe that if they can just get the technical things, then the excellence will be there. And maybe that's a path that works for some people, but in my experience and observations, it's really the other way around, that you're never going to get above 80%, unless you take care of that other stuff first.
Make sure you're happy with where you are and enjoying the process and enjoying the production, the work. And then you'll rise to meet the rest of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. I'm constantly going back and forth on that, fighting myself on, you know, why am I even doing this if I can't do it perfectly? And then reminding myself, just enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
And then you'll feel better about the finished product. I've done stuff that, you know, if I look back, you know, listen to the tape after the fact, you're like, oh, that wasn't technically that great. But my memory was that I really enjoyed it, and it was a fun thing to do. And totally. I think that sticks with the performer anyway, more than anything.
And I should just add not to diminish the fact that practice and technical skills are really, really important.
Yes.
But it can be easy to believe that that's all that there is.
Mm.
When really that's just that's one of the tools.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about artists that, especially like, you know, maybe some alternative or punk style artists who aren't technically great, but you know, you see them on stage and they're selling it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what that phrase comes from. Or a comedian who, you know, maybe the material isn't totally there, but you know, you can tell they're having a good time, they're smiling, they're bringing the audience into the fun of the moment. Even, you know, so regardless of the quality of the material itself, it buys you, not the whole way, of course, but it buys you more than you might think.
Yeah.
That's very true. So speaking of getting involved, you also got involved at something that I brought up at the beginning, the Stuck in Vermont 500th episode
thing. Yes.
I figured that was, you know, that was more than just another tune that you whipped off. That was a hell of a production.
That was a blast. So that was with Ava Salberger, and who I actually met doing theater a decade or so ago now at this point. But that was a really fun project. I wrote a sort of big opening number for her 500th episode, and some other incidental music for the episode, and pulled in a bunch of people to record it.
What was the original thinking behind doing this?
Ava had emailed me or called it. I don't remember now, but she had really wanted to do a musical number, a musical episode for her 500th. And I think that when we talked, she said, "Oh, it's sort of, you know, like the Buffy episode."
Yeah.
if your listeners were Buffy the Vampire Slayer fans, and I think it scaled back a little bit from that, because not only is that really was that a very daunting undertaking, get, you know, she had a lot of really great guests on that episode, who we weren't going to be rehearsing. None of this was stuff that was going to, like, we weren't going to get people to, oh, here, like, learn your melody, learn your rhythm, and then we'll, it wasn't, you know, we weren't able to do that.
Talk about imperfect circumstances.
Exactly. And so it sort of turned into this sort of one opening number and a closing musical number. And then Ava herself sang a couple things in the middle. But of course, you know, she and I had infinite time together, but it's, you know, it's all the other pieces.
Yeah, you brought in some big names, some big Vermont names to... And they just, I basically, you're saying they just, like, learned their parts the day of.
Yeah. None of the guests ended up singing, doing any numbers. So,
right.
And it was because of that. We just sort of, as we were working on it, it just sort of became clear that getting the guests to sing numbers was going to be more work and time and money,
because they'd need to come into the studio and record, but also need to be there for the video
shoot. So
that's a bigger commitment.
So I called a bunch of friends to come and be backup singers for the big opening number. Ava got Lois Trombley to get a bunch of people to be dancers for the big opening scene, and it was a lot of fun and a surprisingly large amount of work not even talking about what Ava had to do for the whole episode, which was really long, she spent so much more time. My time was a drop in the bucket, but even for the small amount that I did, it was a lot, and it was really my first experience with I don't know if you call it television. Do you talk about television anymore these days, or is it video? Just video?
We'll just YouTube? Call it video.
You know, but how much sort of work and prep has to go into that, and how it's really different than live theater, where you sort of like rehearse things and then you do it and it's gone. Right.
And maybe it was good, maybe it wasn't, but you know, who knows? You and I met at, you know, this last summer in doing an improv music workshop, and that you were, I guess, music directing, you were playing piano on. And it's that same thing that's kind of what got me involved, because I have this long streak of perfectionism to the point where it just been driving me crazy.
Right.
You know, I was like, well, the what attracted me about improv is that, you know, if you screw up, that's pretty much part of the process. So, well, first of all, I was kind of curious how you got roped into that, but what are your thoughts on that philosophy of, you know, the benefits of not being able to nail things down, of the theater being of the moment?
I recently sort of built myself a website And I was running into this, and even though I sort of knew it, I was like, man, I really would love to have like clips of my stuff, even just small ones. I'm like, it's hard for me to find them and, mm-hmm. and to find them at any quality
right.
that are worth it, because you're not allowed to do video recordings of most produced shows out of New York,
right. Or anywhere,
or anywhere. Yeah. But they're really strict about their licensing and what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. So yeah, I've done so many things that I have a program in a shoebox, and probably some pictures on Facebook if I scroll back far enough,
and you just have to use your memory to connect the photo with the moment.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's what you have to work with. Are you still doing much music directing? Who are you working with now?
Sure, I'm still really busy all the time. A couple years ago, I sort of decided that I didn't like being as poor as I was, and it's hard to not be poor as a full time musician, especially in a town as small as this.
Yeah.
So I'm working a day job these days, but 5:30 to 10:30 is still theater time.
Nice.
I'm not doing school stuff as much, because that generally
that'd be during the day.
Rehearses right after school, and I'm at work. But I'm still really active with Lyric Theater. Hmm. I'm music direct for them and play piano and all sorts of other things. And I'm music direct for Spielplast Cabaret. We have a show coming up in May. People should get their tickets.
Tell me about that. So Spielplast, I've seen that a few times now.
Oh, Spielplast is great. And I am probably not the greatest spokesperson.
Yeah.
because I've been involved for four. This is my fifth year, I think.
Yeah. As music director?
Third as music director.
Gotcha, gotcha.
And then I was a piano player in the band for 2 years before that.
Yeah.
Spielplast Cabaret has been around since 2002 or 3,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And it's basically a performance art cabaret
Yeah.
style thing that gets its inspiration and aesthetic from the salons and sort of a dadaist performance of pre-war
yeah.
France and Germany.
Is it about that style that draws you in?
It's interesting because it's not sort of like the French band. It's not necessarily an idiom that I had worked in a lot mm-hmm. before, but there's a lot of using theater as political and personal statement is really exciting, and for Spielplast we sort of build the show fresh every year, and it's a very collaborative process from the ground up, which is really really different than all the other theater work that I do,
where you get a script and you get the book and the music and that's what you play.
Exactly. Right.
Whereas Spielplast, it's like each performer kind of picks their own piece or collaboratively puts their piece together?
Yes. And then I'll write songs and arrangements, or sometimes the performers write their own and bring it to me and say, hey, can you take this outline
yeah.
and fit it onto the Spielplast band and make it happen. So it's really exercises a different part of different set of skills for me.
Where are you guys? So it's in May?
It's in May. It's the last two weekends in May. I don't know the exact dates in front yeah. of me, but we're at the Main Street Landing Theater above okay. Skinny Pancake.
Gotcha, yeah.
So two weekends there. And then actually the following Saturday at the end of Jazz Fest, we're going to be at the Big Picture in Waitsfield. So that'll be sort of a road gig for us.
Well, let's talk about road gigs. Let's talk about the road in Vermont then. How's that for a segue? Talking about Waitsfield and yeah. the rest of Vermont, because that's another thing that you and I connected on. We're connected on Facebook, and that's come up a few times, is the 251 trek.
Yes, yes.
To visit all 251 towns and cities. So how far in are you now?
So I'm doing the 251 with my fiance Alex, and mm-hmm. we are, I think
14 towns in right now. Yeah. We're taking a pretty slow slow and leisurely approach to it.
is Alex a Vermonter?
She's one of those who came to Burlington for UVM and stayed, but she's from Massachusetts originally.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah, we're my wife and I were I want to say 155 in. Wow. I think we started, I want to say, 2.5, 3 years ago. Yeah, we've definitely gone on a few splurges, a few binge weekends, you know, where we'll hit like 15 or whatever.
Wow.
But yeah, and then there'll be like, you know, a month or two between treks. What was it, because you've lived here your whole life, what was it that made you say, you know what, I really want to see the whole of, you know, all of Vermont in a way that I hadn't before?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of been on my radar for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think Alex actually had suggested to me, we should actually do this. Let's let's go. And she sent the check-in, and we got our notebook and checklist from the 251 club. So that made it real, I guess.
But once you spend money on it, you have to do it. It's like a gym membership.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But you know, so I've lived here my whole life, and part of that has been time. Part of my time here has been spent thinking about why this is the choice that I made, right? And I do love it in Vermont. I love the people in Vermont. I love the landscape of Vermont, and I love how you can go over that next set of hills, and there's a town that you've never seen before, sort of, you know, nestled in among the trees or whatever.
Yeah.
So there are all these places. They may be small, but they're places I've never seen. That they're new. Yeah. They can be new to me for the first time. And every place is special to someone, right? There's something that's a spark about a location.
Anywhere,
right? Not just Vermont. And so this sort of idea of like of going to places and just sort of trying, seeing what it is,
Experiencing it is. Someone else's love, experiencing someone else's point of view through. Well, that's what travel. That's why people say you got to travel.
Right.
People, you know, I've heard it. You should go abroad. You know, see. Mm-hmm. You know, all of Europe, see, you know, this country and that country. And I was like, I haven't seen all of Vermont yet.
Yeah.
And every time, we go out, we see another perspective. We see another layer, another angle.
Yeah.
To Vermont.
I mean, Europe's pretty great, too.
I guess.
You know, living in Vermont, Vermont is really accessible, and both time-wise and money-wise, and like all this other stuff, stuff, right? So it is. It's great to go other places, but if there's a Saturday that I don't want to just do the same old whatever I'm usually going to do on a Saturday, we can say let's pull up the map and pick a. Direction. We'll Google, see what museum or landscape feature or cool thing there is there, and where's good to eat lunch, and go, and it's something new that happens.
Yeah, what I find is if we plan even just like a day or two ahead, I can post on Facebook and says we're going to hit these 5 or 6 towns. That's what you did when you suggested Rainbow Suites.
Yeah.
To me a few weeks ago, I get that same thing. I was like, okay, we're going to hit, you know, Marshfield and this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And people come out of the woodwork. All of your friends will say, oh, you got to check out this place. You got to check out this place to eat and that place to eat and this, you know, view.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because we were just talking about visiting, experiencing someone else's love and perspective on their home. But then to also hear from all of my other friends who live in Chittenden County usually, and what they've experienced.
Yeah. Yeah. It's endless. The number of perspectives on any place is only as small as the number of people who've been there and have an opinion, right?
Well put.
So I feel fortunate, I guess, that there's something in me that really does sort of get a kick and find like peace and joy out of stepping out of my car, out of my door, and just sort of looking around and going, oh, this is the world I'm in, or this is the town I've ended up in. Look at this. This is cool. Yeah, there's that
tree
is neat. Look at that building with the boarded up windows up top. or look at that renovated grist mill. That's an art gallery now, or, you know, all this kind of stuff that just makes up the landscape and the, aesthetic or, whatever of Vermont.
Well, let's continue talking about Vermont.
Yeah.
Well, let's wrap up by talking about your favorite things about Vermont. So I asked all my guests the same four questions, and I think you did a little preparation, a little bit of studying.
A little bit.
So your favorite Vermonter, and I was very curious to hear the story behind your favorite Vermonter / Vermonters.
Yes. So as a UVM student, mm-hmm. I, of course, could not help but know the names Marsh and Billings, right? Because there's Marsh Life Sciences building and Billings Student Center, which I think maybe even now it's not the Student Center anymore. I can't keep track of that. But anyway, these, you know, names, Vermont names that I knew as a student but didn't really know who they were. And at one point, not on the 251 Club, but on a visit, a local vacation to Woodstock, where the Marsh, we have a national forest in Woodstock that is Billings, Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Park. There's a farm there, and it turns out that Marsh was this, well-to-do upper-class Vermonter, but he's sort of important because he wrote this book about conservation, basically, before conservation existed. He sort of wrote a lot about this idea that humans can affect the landscape. And it's not just when stuff happens, it's not just accidental.
It was revolutionary at the time.
It was, right? It seems very, in 2018, it seems very obvious. But this, and this idea that resource scarcity, it's not because that you're running out of resources, but because you're not managing it well, right? Like, it's resource scarcity is a human consequence, not an environmental consequence.
I see.
So Marsh had sort of created this conservationist movement concept or whatever, and then Billings ended up buying the Marsh farm in Woodstock. He was also a Vermonter, but he bought it and then sort of did the practical end of taking that concept of conservation and putting it into practice.
I see.
Billings was instrumental in the reforestation of Vermont.
So of all these places around Vermont, what is your favorite?
Oh, I hate favorites. I've never been a fan of
sorry, Nate, but the name of the show is Vermont Favorites.
I know. I realize that. I don't hate this show, but I hate favorites.
I won't take offense.
Good. I mean, and you had me think about this ahead of time. The top of Mount Mansfield is such a great place. And I think I wrote on my form.
Yep.
I have never, it's the one place I have gone to in Vermont where I have never been less than ecstatic in that place. Right. I mean, climb this mountain. It's beautiful up here.
Yeah.
I think that's got to rank right up there.
That's a good answer
for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Can't argue with that. Your favorite Vermont memory. Basically,
you
know, your whole life.
My whole life is a Vermont memory. But, you know, I loved my kindergarten. We had horses at my kindergarten. I got to ride horses at kindergarten. You know, I really appreciate, even though in Chittenden County, it wasn't rural. In fact, in some ways, I really love that. I feel like I had a large element of sort of a rural upbringing while still, being, 10 miles from Burlington and that kind of thing. So, childhood in the Burlington outskirts, at least for me was pretty great. So
yeah, growing up in the 80s was pretty great also. I didn't grow up here, but yeah, just that. It was like almost like the last generation before things really started to get crazy with our connectivity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really get lost, like you were allowed to.
Yeah.
Your favorite Vermont food and or drink?
Oh, man.
Or maybe just your favorite place to get.
Yes. Yeah. So I, my favorite Vermont drink, I mean, I've got to say I'm a little biased. So I live in Winooski right now. Mm-hmm. And Four Quarters Brewery, which is a few blocks from where I live. Yeah. Brian Eckert does really great and interesting beers. And I love his place and his stuff a lot. So that's their apple cider. Of mm-hmm. course, the ultimate juice.
Yeah.
And food, you know, there are so many great places. I love Trattoria Delia on Church Street or on St. Paul Street in Burlington. Right. That's been a favorite of mine. I've been going there for my birthday since college, probably. I love the food there. And I'm half of my heritage is Italian, and so I have a strong affinity for good Italian food. So yeah, that's probably my favorite for the moment.
Always willing to be proved wrong.
Yes,
that's a great way to go through life. So how can people find you online, see what you're working on next or what you're up to?
Oh, I'm everywhere online. There aren't that many people who share my name, so you can just Google me. But I do natevinette.com is my half-finished website, and you can find me on Facebook and all that kind of stuff. But yeah. I am available for all your musical needs. so get in touch.
Good. Well, that was your plug. Yeah. And you nailed it. You nailed it. Well, thank you for chatting today. I've been talking with Nate Vinette, who is a Vermont native and loves it here and doesn't seem to want to leave. I don't blame him. Thank you for chatting today. You can follow Vermont Favorites on Facebook. Even if you don't like favorites, you don't want to play favorites, it's understandable. If you want to find out about upcoming guests, you can follow Vermont Favorites on Facebook. And you can subscribe to the podcast version of this show and catch up on any episodes you've missed at imadeitup.com. Vermont Favorites is a production of WBTV LP 99.3 FM Burlington, online at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm Adam Rabin. Thank you for listening. Take care.